billions of bacteria cells in a petri dish. A few mutated cells that happen to be resistant to that drug remain. Those few cells can then give rise to a colony of resistant bacteria. The question is, how well does this mutant strain survive in the long run? This can be measured in what scientists call fitness cost. How well does this mutant bacteria survive when the drug is removed and it now must compete with the original parent bacteria?
These organisms are not able to grow with the fidelity, the robustness that the original parent did, and that's one of the things that we've been looking at. So you can take a culture of cells that are sensitive to the drug, plate them out on petri dishes that have the drug, but there's a single colony coming up that's resistant to the drug. One cell that gave rise to this colony was resistant to the drug out of 4 billion. If this is the parental strain, we now have a mutant, we grow them up separately, and then we put them in the same test tube without the drug. So now we've removed selection, and we can measure empirically the fitness cost in terms of how well the resistant organism can now compete with its parent.
The surprising result is that in a relatively short period of time, the resistant bacteria lose out in their competition with the parent. They can't reproduce as fast, and over a short time disappear.
Within one or two transfers of overnights, you can lose that population of resistant cells, and then after the third transfer, the resistant isolate has been completely outcompeted by the parent. It turns out that the resistant strain has a defect in its information processing system. The cell's crippled, and there's a limit to how much change can occur. When the resistant strain comes into contact with a parental wild type in nature, the parental wild type will reestablish dominance in the population, resulting in no net evolutionary change. We're going backwards in terms of the fitness of these organisms, not forwards, as used as an example of evolution.
According to critics of Darwin's theory, finch beaks, four-winged fruit flies, and drug-resistant bacteria always problems for the neo-Darwinian claim that random mutations and natural selection drive the development of life. But there's another part of Darwin's theory that is also being challenged by some scientists. That's the claim that all living things are ultimately descended from a common ancestor. This claim underlies perhaps the biggest icon of evolution of all. The Tree of Life.
The classical Darwinian picture of the history of life is that of a tree, that these small incremental changes build up and they branch out, and so you start from very simple life and eventually you get everything that we have around us, from elephants to alligators to chimpanzees and everything in between.
Critics say that evidence used to support Darwin's Tree of Life is just as questionable as evidence used for the other icons of evolution. One major piece of evidence used to support the Tree of Life is homology.
There is the front flipper, a hand built on the same model as my own hand.
Biologists define homology as similarity in structure between different organisms.
Now this has the same design exactly as your arm. There's the upper arm.
My textbook would show the forelimb, a hand, and it would show a bat's wing and a whale's flipper, and say because they have similar structure, have similar bone pattern, that they must share a common ancestor.
And then the five very long fingers, just like yours.
The mere pattern of the bones doesn't tell you how it happened. You have to supply a mechanism to explain how it got that way. Well, Darwin's mechanism, as understood by modern Darwinists, was genetic. You inherited similar genes, and these genes made the bones grow the way they do. The problem is that the evidence doesn't fit that explanation.
According to modern Darwinism, if two structures are similar because of common ancestry, each structure should be produced by similar genes and go through a similar pattern of development in the embryo. The contrary to these predictions, biologists are learning that homologous structures can be produced by different genes and follow different patterns of development. For example, biologists consider the body segments of fruit flies and wasps as homologous. Darwinism predicts that these similarities should be due to the same gene. But in fact, different genes account for the development of body segments in these insects. This contradicts the idea that homology must point to common ancestry. In the same way, many body structures considered homologous by biologists develop in embryos in fundamentally different ways. One example is the gut in vertebrates.
If the Darwinian theory were correct, the process by which the gut is constructed should itself be homologous. In fact, this isn't the case. We know, for instance, that in different vertebrates, the gut is constructed in very different ways during development.
In sharks, the gut develops from cells in the roof of the embryonic cavity. In lampreys, the gut develops from cells on the floor of the embryonic cavity. And in frogs, the gut develops from cells in both the roof and the floor.
So you have a homologous structure in vertebrates that is built in one way in a shark, in one way in a lamprey, in another way in frogs, and you've got these very different developmental pathways converging to the same structure. This is very hard to reconcile with Darwinian common descent.
These marine reptiles were built on much the same plan as you are.
I would say, in the past 20 years of studying this problem, that biology is now entering what can only be described as a revolution, because the evidence is so overwhelmingly against the conventional neo-Darwinian view.
Now, what about those other reptiles that flew in the air?
If homology doesn't provide evidence for the tree of life, what does? A second proof usually offered is the fossil record. According to most biology textbooks, fossils show the gradual development of life from simple to complex over hundreds of millions of years. But a growing number of scientists say that this textbook story is incomplete and even misleading, because it ignores an extraordinary event in the history of life known as the Cambrian explosion.
The Cambrian explosion is a term that refers to the geologically sudden appearance of all the major, or most of the major groups of animals, at about the same time, geologically speaking.
Most geologists date the Cambrian explosion at 530 to 520 million years ago.
The Cambrian explosion is a name given to a geologic event, really, the appearance in the fossil record over a period of about 10 million years or slightly less of a skeletonized fauna that includes many living phyla for the first time.
Animals with similar body plans are grouped together to form various phyla.
Indeed, if you look at the tree of life, you can infer that nearly or all living phyla had evolved by the end of the explosion period.
The Cambrian explosion has been called life's Big Bang, or at least animals' Big Bang, because in the Cambrian explosion, most of the major forms of animals appear very suddenly, in a geological sense. From nothing, we have almost everything, almost overnight, geologically speaking. This remains mysterious. Nobody really understands how this happened.
The explosion is real in the sense that the fossils are real. There they are. Explaining it, however, is controversial. We're not sure just how far back animals originated before the explosion or what the events were that led up to it.
In Darwin's theory, if you think of the branching tree, Darwin's branching tree, the common ancestor down here and the different modern forms of animals up here, you would have one form to begin with, and then it would gradually diverge into slightly different forms and more different until you get the major differences that we see now. The problem with the Cambrian explosion is that all these major differences appear together at the same time, with no fossil evidence that they descended from this common ancestor.
You have a sudden emergence of new biological form and structure. And the suddenness of it defies the Darwinian mechanism's ability to produce new structure. Darwin believed that his mechanism must act slowly through small, gradual, incremental changes. And as a result, he expected to find many transitional intermediate forms from the very simplest organisms to the first animals.
Darwin knew about the Cambrian fossil record, and he considered it a serious problem for his theory. He hoped that future fossil collecting would fill in the gaps somewhat and make the theory more plausible. But in fact, 150 years of continued fossil collecting have made the problem worse. Many more types of animals were involved than Darwin knew about. So it's actually more of an explosion now than Darwin thought it was.
Most biology textbooks, however, supply little information about the Cambrian explosion, if they even mention it at all.
My textbook gives a one-sentence statement, just that there was this Cambrian explosion of life. But then it goes on to give a traditional Darwinian theory as to this slow, gradual evolving process.
DeHart wanted to supplement the solitary sentence in the biology textbook with an article that appeared in the Boston Globe. The article reported on cutting-edge research by Chinese scientist J.Y. Chen, an internationally respected paleontologist at the Nanjing Institute of Paleontology and Geology. Chen's discoveries in the fossil beds in Xinjiang, China, have rocked the scientific establishment. Located in the province of Yunnan in southern China, Xinjiang has some of the world's best preserved fossils from the Cambrian era.
Darwinism helps them, maybe only telling a part story for evolution.
According to Chen, the fossils he's discovered turn Darwin's tree of life upside down.
Darwin's tree, you know, reverse conship, very unexpectedly, our research is convincing major phyla starting down below at beginning of Cambrian. Base is white, gradually narrow, so this is almost turned down different way.
I do not believe that animals developed gradually from the bottom up. I think the animals suddenly appeared. Among the Xinjiang animals, we have found 136 different kinds of animals, and they represent diversity in the level of phyla and classes. So the sudden appearance makes them very special.
One view that many paleontologists hold is that though the phyla appeared suddenly during the Cambrian explosion, there must have been a long period of evolutionary development before that event.
Some people believe that it was a very rapid origin of these body plans. Other people believe it was a long, gradual buildup to it, which I think is probably right. But there must have been a prehistory in which it started at the bottom and worked up to the phyla.
If there was a long history of evolution prior to the Cambrian explosion, there should be an abundance of transitional fossils. Or perhaps those animals were too small or soft-bodied to be preserved.
The Darwinists have known since the 19th century that the Cambrian explosion did not conform to the picture of life that Darwin proposed. But one of their explanations for that was something called the artifact hypothesis, the idea that we were simply not sampling the fossil record sufficiently to find the missing transitional intermediates. In the strata just beneath the Cambrian fossil beds, we have a very favorable environment that would have preserved ancestral forms of these animals had they existed. So one of the versions of the artifact hypothesis was the claim that we don't find these missing Precambrian animals because they were too small and they were soft-bodied. And what we now find in the Chinese fossils in the beds just beneath the Cambrian explosion are perfectly preserved, soft-bodied tissues, sponge embryos that are, of course, soft and microscopic. The new finds in the Chengjiang formations really completely put to rest the artifact hypothesis. If you can preserve an embryo, you can preserve an animal. And if those animals were there, then we should have found them. And they're not there.
Some defenders of Darwin's theory argue that random mutations in a special set of genes called Hox genes are responsible for dramatically speeding up the evolutionary process during the Cambrian period.
But what's interesting to me is that these genes are turned on late in development, long after the body plan is established. A fruit fly is already a fruit fly embryo before the Hox genes kick in. The same for a human, or a worm, or a starfish.
So without a mechanism for sudden mutation, or a record of transitional fossils, critics say Darwin's theory lacks the evidence it needs to account for the remarkable Cambrian explosion. While scientists in China are being allowed to raise tough questions about Darwin, back in Burlington, Roger DeHart's request to show students the article about the Chinese fossils is refused. But he's in for an even greater disappointment. After 15 years of teaching biology in his district, DeHart is informed during the summer that he has been reassigned. His biology courses will be taught by someone just out of college who majored in physical education, not biology like DeHart.
Certainly, we knew that there would be people that would be concerned, people that would think we were trying to do something to Roger. But that's not why we make decisions around here.
Regardless of the reasons for DeHart's reassignment, the question still needs to be asked. Does a high school teacher have the right to present information critical of an accepted scientific theory? And just how should public schools handle a controversial issue like evolution?
A very popular American tradition is the fairness, or let's let all sides have their say and so forth. This is a wonderful cultural tradition. It's irrelevant in science. It sounds really unfair, but it isn't the job of the high school teacher to decide that students need to be exposed to views that are on the fringe of science. I mean, the job of the high school teacher is to try to communicate the consensus view of science. Otherwise, you're really misleading those kids.
But what happens if scientists have different views? Who is to say whose views should be heard?
School districts face jeopardy if they allow the science classroom to be used as a means of religious indoctrination. But they also face jeopardy if they engage in viewpoint discrimination. The Supreme Court has been very clear that school boards have no right to remove offending viewpoints simply because they disagree with them.
Even if some scientists challenge evolution, are high school teachers and their students equipped to hear about such disagreements?
The role of a high school teacher is not to be on the cutting edge of research, and it's not doing the students any service to confuse them about some of the esoteric elements of a scientific discipline.
I find the fact that they think that freshmen aren't capable of looking at facts and looking where they lead very insulting.
I'm a little insulted if someone says that, you know, having more than one side to a theory is going to be too complex for a high school mind.
This is biology 101. I mean, they have kids' books on the topic. If they think that we cannot handle or we are not capable of understanding the complexities of the argument, we shouldn't be in high school.
My experience is students will rise to the occasion, and the more controversial, the more interested they'll become. Often controversy is the way to get students involved in any discipline.
The idea that the high school has to be a kind of enlarged locker room where only the coach's pep talk is considered reasonable, that should be repugnant. That's not really how we want an educational establishment to be run, is it? let's give high school students the benefit of the doubt. Let's say that they're a whole lot more intelligent, presentable, better dressed, better groomed, smarter, more sophisticated than they give every appearance of being.
Right now, they're treated to a dogma, and when they know it's a dogma, they lose interest. So real education will take place when students are allowed to know there's a controversy in science.
The debate over how to teach evolution is likely to get more intense. As part of a landmark education law passed in 2001, Congress mandated that each state develop uniform standards for teaching science. Defenders of Darwin's theory want these standards to discourage any discussion of alternate viewpoints about evolution. But Congress encouraged states to adopt a more inclusive approach, urging that where topics are taught that may generate controversy, such as biological evolution, the curriculum should help students to understand the full range of scientific views that exist, why such topics may generate controversy, and how scientific discoveries can profoundly affect society. Congressional support for teaching both sides of the evolution debate has been bipartisan and spanned the political spectrum.
So I think there are many benefits to this discussion that we hope to encourage in science classrooms across this country. And I frankly don't see any downside to this discussion, that we are standing here as the Senate in favor of intellectual freedom and open and fair discussion.
We want to children to be able to talk and speak and examine various scientific theories with the basis of all of the information that is available to them.
There are increasing signs that the public agrees that teachers should be able to present more than one view about evolution. According to a recent Zogby poll, 71% of Americans agree that biology teachers should teach Darwin's theory of evolution, but also the scientific evidence against it. Only 15% of the public think that biology teachers should teach only Darwin's theory and the scientific evidence that supports it. And in the scientific community, growing numbers of scholars are expressing doubts about Darwin's theory and calling for an open hearing for their views. More than 100 scientists, including scholars from Yale, Princeton, MIT, and the Smithsonian, signed on to a statement declaring that they were skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination of the evidence for Darwinian theory should be encouraged. The declaration ran as an ad in the prestigious New York Review of Books. Some school districts are allowing teachers more freedom to discuss the controversy over evolution. High school biology teacher Doug Cowan has been supplementing the approved curriculum for years.
I start my unit on evolution with a statement that says we're going to teach evolution as science. We're going to show not only the confirming evidence and the support that it has in a very forceful way, but we're also going to show some of the anomalies of evolutionary theory that are bringing many scientists to doubt whether Darwin had it right in the beginning.
There's a false belief out there that it's somehow unconstitutional or against the First Amendment to allow a teacher to criticize Darwin's theory in the classroom. And that's just absolutely false.
Teaching the controversy is really striving for fairness and mutual respect when we approach a controversial issue. I think a school board that does that has the least likelihood of offending either the legal requirements or the political community in which they operate.
The call for greater openness comes too late for Roger DeHart. No longer allowed to teach biology in the Burlington School District, DeHart resigns his position and takes a job in another district.
I've always considered myself as being a science teacher and wanting to teach accurate science. I don't have a desire to be subversive just to be subversive. I see my job as being a science educator and showing students this search for truth and what researchers have actually found.
The Scopes trial stereotype is really now exactly 180 degrees out of sync. The image of the bold, free-thinking evolutionary scientist who was trying to seek the truth, no holds barred, and he was being suppressed by religionists who were threatened by the truth of science. Now I think we have almost exactly the reverse situation.
The people who are really suffering are the students. They're the ones that are not learning the truth about the science and how it's developing. They're being held back.
we are not serving our students well by not allowing them to hear different points of view. We're not training them to be good scientists. Scientists are supposed to question things. Scientists are supposed to be open to new evidence.
I think the best thing I can do as a science educator is to get students to critically think, to be able to look at evidence as given and to be able to interpret those evidences, to ask questions and to make observations.
So teach it more and teach it critically. You know, this is the exceptional area that you can't criticize this doctrine of Darwinism. It's a bad precedent.
What's the loss? What do we risk? Just what do we risk if some of the profound, exciting, deeply perplexing, vexing issues of biology are presented honestly?
Should we teach students the controversy about evolution? Absolutely. This is a controversial theory. Are we going to teach students the truth about it or not?
This has been a Coldwater Media production.